Hello. Can I just say, I'm doing a podcast with my friend Patrick, and please don't disturb us for the next hour and a half, unless I push that button. Thank you. Did you get that, Patrick?
Yeah, heard that. Loud and clear.
So, let's proceed on the assumption that he'll not disturb us.
Okay, good.
All right.
Just a little bit of explanation. I mean, I know I would have liked to have come over today. Frankly, yeah. I was absolutely exhausted yesterday. This is partly, it's all to do with the fuel crisis. It's a fuel crisis
yeah.
meant that I was cycling to work. I cycled, that tired me out. I was caught in a torrential downpour twice last week. That knackered me out even more. Plus, the general stress of how the fuck do I get fuel in my car, which I now need.
Yeah,
was just doing my head. I wasn't actually doing anything. There's no activity yesterday, but I was just stressed out,
yeah.
tired. Anyway, the good news is I've got some fuel now, which is
good.
It's like manna from heaven. You know, it makes you so happy, so happy.
But, good.
Anyway,
and we can do this. And are we going to assume we've done Emmanuel Todd or a lot of it, or are we going to go back to the beginning and do the whole thing?
I would suggest doing the whole thing. I mean, yes, we did do a podcast a long time ago. I even put it
yeah.
up again. Or maybe
Let's do the whole thing.
Yeah, okay, let's do the whole thing. Okay, shall we start then?
Yes.
It is Tuesday, the 5th of October, 2021. I am Patrick Crozier.
I'm Brian Micklethwaite. And I'm in hospital, which may cause complications, but I hope not.
Everything seems fine.
Not in hospital. I'm in a care home, a booper care home.
Everything seems so, pretty good so far.
Yeah.
And we're going to start off talking about, I think we will only talk about, Deirdre McCloskey and Emmanuel Todd.
Yes. Hmm. Well, I've got a complicated thesis to propose, which is that between them, Emmanuel Todd and Deirdre McCloskey have come up between them with the best single explanation for the most important history date in human affairs over the last 1,000 years, which is the Great Wealth Explosion. At the end of the 18th century, in Britain, life started getting better for regular people. And McCloskey spends a long, long time in her books just amassing what she considers to be evidence that this took the form of a different way of thinking. And I think she's right, but I think she weakens her case by ignoring Todd. She seems to have read absolutely everyone except Todd.
When she says it's a way of thinking, does she say the thinking preceded the wealth explosion, or the wealth explosion involved people thinking in a different way, or made them think in a different way?
I think it made them think differently. Let me start with Todd. Todd paints a picture of a civilization that is basically stagnant, military, and fixed sum, being overtaken by a roll of mass literacy which spread across Europe. It started in Germany, then it impacted Britain, most importantly, I think, then France, and then Russia, and then the greatest of the non-European powers, China, it was only quite late on in this story that it became clear that China wasn't going to be a world power in quite the same way that, say, Britain was. I read a book called A War Across All the Oceans, which was about Britain v. France. It was about the Napoleonic Wars. And at the end of it, Britain was the top dog. But it wasn't clear until quite late that that's what Britain and France had been contesting, that status. But it became clear that that's what they were doing. The three of the five national revolutions I've mentioned were taken over, one temporarily and two permanently, by national projects. And when a when an ideological activity becomes
I'm trying to think which ones they are.
France, Russia, China.
Right, okay.
And France, it was temporary. Napoleon threw everything the French had at carving for himself an empire, first in the Middle East, which got kiboshed at the Battle of the Nile when Nelson destroyed Napoleon's fleet, and by some events at Acre, where, much to his surprise, Napoleon was stopped in his tracks at a siege. There's a man called Sir Sidney Smith who figures prominently in this story, and he inflicted upon Napoleon his first land defeat.
God, I've never heard of this one. Okay.
No, I know. It's rather odd, isn't it? He's not a character I know much about. But the story that I read called... we'll have a link to the book. It's by somebody called Adkins and Leslie Adkins, who I think must be his wife. That's a book where we'll footnote in the notes to this thing. This guy, Sidney Smith, is not somebody I've really heard of. I thought, is this a joke, you know, this character? No, not a bit of it. He was intriguing against Napoleon right from the get-go, and eventually was a major part of why he defeated him.
Was he acting as a diplomat or as a soldier?
Both.
Oh, okay.
He was a spy and a soldier. I mean, he supervised the Siege of Acre, but his main achievement was knowing how to defeat Napoleon.
I mean, it almost sounds like he's doing what Wellington was...
And what this meant was that the last three revolutions really had very little, I'm not going to say none, but not nearly as much international appeal as they would have done.
Surely the Russian Revolution had tremendous international appeal.
Well, it did. You'd think tremendous, but I repeat, not as much as the British. And what made the British appeal so successful was first that it never got subsumed as a national British project. It became a claim by British intellectuals and propagandists.
Sorry, when you say a national project, is that the idea of creating a nation?
I mean that no single Brit, like Cromwell, was in charge of it. If he had been, it would have destroyed its international appeal by comparison with the international appeal it actually had, which was phenomenal, earth-shaking. I mean, we're talking about by far, the most successful and effective national revolution, the British Revolution.
I'm a little bit puzzled by that. I mean, you think of all the people having posters of Lenin and things like that, and even during the purges of supporting Stalin.
You'd think. But the truth is that the big history date of the last 1,000 years was the wealth explosion, and it happened in Britain.
Yes.
I can think of two reasons why this isn't better known. One is that the French are embarrassed by this, but Emmanuel Todd's quite open about his admiration for the Anglosphere and what it's now doing globally, which he says is very interesting, you know, Trump, Brexit, all that. And he's quite open about France's difficulties, especially with Germany and the EU and all that. So that...
Well, I hope we can come back to that at some point.
Yeah. The other is, I think the British have become embarrassed by how brilliantly they did.
I mean, it occurred to me when you said to it, maybe there's something else in that... I mean, the French Revolution, for instance...
is going weaker.
Sorry?
Are you hearing... I'm hearing you only a bit.
Oh.
Not as well as I should.
If I move the microphone nearer, does that sound better? Yeah. Where were we?
Where we were was me saying that the British Revolution, and I'm talking about the 18th century, culminating in the moment in about 1780, when everything took off. And from then on, human history was never the same. It was massively better.
Yes.
McCloskey describes this process by immersing herself in all the writings that the English produced around this time and says this is what made the difference. Her argument is a rather strange one. Her argument is that, well, it couldn't have been anything else. It's sort of like the God of the gaps, you know, these creationists who say, well, you can't explain this having evolved, but we can because we've got God on our side. So God must have done it, which I think is a very weak argument.
Yes.
I mean, what if she just got one of the other influences a bit wrong and didn't understand how strong it was? I think she's right, but I think she's right for a reason that only Todd could have told her. And yet, annoyingly, Todd never does tell her. He never got round to explaining why the British Revolution was the British Revolution, not something else. He shrugs his shoulders and says, well, it was only a matter of time before the Germans caught up. And sure enough, they did. At the end of the 19th century, they rearranged their universities and the British were overtaken. Not quite the Anglosphere, which was never really overtaken, was it?
No.
But it's an oddity of Todd's thinking that he has all the right tools in front of him to say that this was the British Revolution that happened. But he doesn't say it.
I'm just trying to think what
and
those...
That,
those...
For that reason, McCloskey doesn't either.
No, I mean, what should he be saying then, do you think?
What?
What should he be saying, do you think?
He should be saying that he wasn't satisfied with his own explanation of how the wealth explosion happened, which as far as he was concerned was anomalous and weird, and eventually it made sense because the Germans got their act together, which at the beginning of the 19th century they had not done, and then all is explained. But he never goes into the details of the British Revolution.
Right.
Very, very
right.
Strange. He wrote The Causes of Progress. No, not that. The Nature of Ideology. I can't remember the title, goddammit. The books are in this room, but they're at the other end of it. The Explanation of Ideology, that's right. He doesn't realise that the British Revolution is a uniquely British event. Partly, I think, it's because the British, the Anglosphere thinkers now responding to Todd are also not interested in this wealth explosion. They're much more interested in Brexit and Trump and all that. And Todd has very interesting things to say about what he calls Homo Americanus, whom he regards as very similar to original human nature, which is
yes.
A lot to explain why American culture has its present.
And what does that involve?
Well, it's not complicated family structure. It's a simple sort of nuclear family kind of invention. And that is a much more economically progressive thing than the elaborately constructed families of the world islands, China and India and all these places. Does that make sense? You see, in the
Brian, can
the,
I just stop you there?
In the Explanation of Ideology, Todd treats family structure as a given at the point when literacy arrives in the country. And that's a perfectly good way of looking at it. But in his latest book, which is called Lineages of Modernity, have a note to that. He regards the evolution of family structure as a very interesting matter. How did that happen? And he writes a lot about that.
Brian, can I just stop you there? We are suffering from appalling interference. I am, at least. I don't know what it's like for you. I'm gonna hang up and redial.
Okay.
I'll be with you in a minute.
All right.
Right, we're recording again. Good. Excellent. Yes, so we're talking about Todd and the Industrial Revolution and family structure and how it evolves, which is...
Yes. And Deirdre McCloskey insisting that it's nothing to do with family structure. It's all to do with the way thinking was going on in Britain in the 18th and then the end of the 18th century. And I agree with her. Her strongest argument is that this process is one of a series of earth-shakingly ideologically impressive events, including, as you rightly say, the Russian and the Chinese revolutions, which, despite being taken over by individuals, nevertheless had a lot of international impact. But what McCloskey doesn't realise is that the description of the transformation that happened in Britain fits perfectly into this succession of national events, and therefore was a much more solid event than she realises. It was going to have consequences.
So, sorry, we're talking about the national events, we're talking about revolutions here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
National revolutions. That includes, I say it again, I can't repeat it too often. The wealth explosion was the British National Revolution, and it has been by far, the most significant of these global events.
Yes. Yes, it has transformed things, and. Yeah, and it was people who wanted
it to
happen.
It's rescued the entire world from that fixed sum nightmare of the only way of being able to get somewhere in the world is to be a soldier and win wars, which of course is a very chancy thing.
Yeah,
it's a lottery in the worst sense, and so McCloskey speaks more truly than she knows, or would have done if she'd understood what Todd should have said. Or if Todd had said it. Both of them are at fault. My feeling
What is Todd missing out on, in that he doesn't describe...
He's missing out on... He doesn't understand the British Revolution.
Right. He doesn't understand he that it was a revolution.
He doesn't grasp that the wealth explosion that took off in Britain in 1780 was the British Revolution. And as such, the most important of those five, or of any subsequent one that happened.
Yeah, yeah. We'll have to put up a link to... Because my question... You answered my question from the last time round is why it took so long from the political revolution of the 1700s to the economic revolution of the 1800s.
Well, there are two reasons for that. First of all, it took the British a long time to work out what their final great power status would be in the old world, you know. And the answer was top dog, and it didn't emerge until the mid-19th century. So it took a long time. And second... Creativity.
Mid-18th century, don't you mean?
I mean the 19th century.
Oh, okay.
It was only after Napoleon was defeated that it was clear that the British had the supreme position.
Right.
The other reason it took a long time was that persuasive creativity does take a long time. You see, the British Revolution...
Persuasive creativity?
It didn't happen because the British... forced other countries to accept their ideas. It happened because they were good ideas and they were persuasive ideas and they worked and everyone could see they worked.
I mean, for instance, the Russian, the British and the French defeated the Russians in the Crimean War. They destroyed Sevastopol, and this forced the Russians to think, well, hang about, we better learn, because if we don't learn from these people, we're going to get destroyed.
Yeah.
Is that the sort of persuasive creativity we're talking about?
Yeah. Right. And the Germans were famous at the beginning of the 19th century for producing symphonies and poetry and philosophy, but for most of them, not knowing where the hell the next meal was coming from. And same was true of the Scandinavians. So they decided to get their act together. And they weren't put off by any English person being too powerful and bullying. I mean, Napoleon, for example, liberty, equality, fraternity. Oh, and by the way, unless you surrender Napoleon's armies, he's going to shower you with artillery shells.
Yeah.
Not exactly a persuasive combination of arguments.
No.
And French revolutionary ideals only started to have an impact when Napoleon was separated from them.
Really?
Yes, really. Mm. Mid-19th century Europe.
We're talking about equality, fraternity, and the other one.
Liberty, equality, fraternity spread in Europe after Napoleon was defeated and didn't spread while he was in action because he put everybody off it.
The point is you can't spread these things through the barrel. The point being you can't spread these things.
I'm not hearing you.
Right, hello.
No, not good enough. I can hear you, but it's not good enough.
Oh, drat.
Is that better?
That's better from my point of view.
I think I had the phone in the wrong position, sorry.
Oh, right, okay, well, that's a lot better indeed, yes.
Yeah, because that means you'll get everything.
Right.
Yeah.
Good. Good. That's really it.
That's really what I want to say, that McCloskey and Todd, between them, could have cracked this, but in fact, they required the intervention of Micklethwaite to explain to them what they were thinking.
Right, I think.
Which is putting it strongly, but I believe that to be true.
I'm going to try to summarise that, and I'm failing. So let's see if I got this right. Todd is saying this is to do with the spread of literacy.
Yes.
And McCloskey has said this is to do with ideology.
Yes,
and
which is also literacy.
The missing link is, yes, literacy leads to ideology.
Yeah.
Golly, have I got that right? I'm amazed.
Literacy what? What did you say, literacy?
Literacy leads to ideology.
Yes. It has two distinct effects. One is it creates the battle you always go on about between the new middling men and the old aristocracy. Always with that.
Yeah.
And it's always a bloody turmoil. I mean, the German religious wars of the 16th century were terrible. The English wars of the 17th century were terrible and sucked the Irish and all of them into it.
And the Scots.
Yep, and the Scots, that's right. And as I say, that British old school conflict never really got sorted until Napoleon was defeated.
Didn't it? I thought it just kept going.
Well, that's
still,
right.
It still does going. From time to time.
It sort of still does, but Todd has accepted that, and I think the French have accepted that the Anglosphere is working or has worked in a way that France hasn't. I mean, the French intelligentsia committed themselves to a top-down French state, and that's never the way to make these things work. That always goes wrong. And the French Revolution didn't provoke the wealth explosion because it had the wrong kind of state.
The wrong kind and in being very highly centralised or...
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Or big.
Bossy. And you're not allowed to do things until the government says you can and all that.
Yeah. Yeah. I understand that after the Second World War, the French were far more liberal. And, of course, that is why, when I was growing up, the French were way ahead of us.
Yeah, that's right.
In similar vein, they were quite liberal after the Franco-Prussian War.
Yes.
And that's why you got the Belle Epoque, and they were leaders in things like motor cars and aircraft up until the First World War. Precisely because of this. They had this bit of freedom, mainly through political failure, and did very well, thank you.
Yeah, that's right. That's about it. I think I've told the story, actually.
Right. Well, we can stop there, then.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I want to make clear that I attach great importance to my own opinions about this. I have solved the problem that McCloskey and Todd did not. That's quite a claim, but I make it.
Yes. Well, maybe we have to tell these people that you're...
Yeah, you've got it. You've got to tell them. Yeah. And McCloskey should be emailed with this, and so should Todd.
Mm-hmm.
It is quite remarkable that McCloskey's books don't footnote Todd. She's read everyone, or so she claims, but not Todd. Shame on her. That's a big...
I mean, is there any explanation for that, do you think? I mean, maybe she hasn't heard of him.
Well, the thing is, Todd doesn't explain himself properly, so why would McCloskey take him as seriously as he doesn't take himself?
Oh, I see. Because of the Micklethwaite gap, he
that's right.
Yeah,
that's correct.
Yeah. Mm.
I assume Todd would explain the Micklethwaite gap in his latest book, in Lineages and Modernity, but he doesn't. He shrugged his shoulders in the same old way. It's bizarre, and he goes wibbling on about English family structure as if that was decisive. All that mattered was that family structure was what it was when literacy erupted over England, and the new men's opinions started to counter things.
Are we saying it's unimportant? Because I always thought you said it was important, family structure. That's a big part of Todd, isn't it?
Well, it's a bit Toddish, but the point of the family structure is that it determines what the new men were thinking was how humanity could improve itself. And he doesn't go into that.
Ah, right.
And he should. He should.
Yeah.
So I mark Todd down and I mark McCloskey down. And if they both get their bits right, then between them, they have it all. They have the whole story. As it is, the only one with the whole story is me. I can't put it more provocatively and annoyingly than that.
And anyone who listens to this?
Anyone who listens to this is hearing this story, I think, for the first time.
Right. Oh, God.
And it's the most important. It's the most important history date of the last 1,000 years, by far.
By far. Oh, a few other 1,000 years as well.
Yeah.
I think.
And it couldn't have been all the things that were going on all that time, you know, commerce and capital accumulation, because that was all happening. But the wealth explosion did not happen. Why not? Because they haven't heard me explain why not. So, yeah. Strong stuff.
Yes, this will be
I'm a dying man, and, well, I think you can see why I wanted to get this said.
Yes.
We had a previous go at McCloskey and Emmanuel Todd, but I don't think I said it as clearly there.
Yeah, we had the Industrial Revolution podcast we did. Many years ago we did a podcast on Todd. We had you did a blog posting after that about how precisely what you meant by the English Revolution, English National Revolution, British National Revolution.
Yeah, I'm still confused by whether to call it English or British, but it meant that was a distinction that meant less in those days.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure either.
Anyway, it was one or the other.
Yeah.
It was that thing.
Yes.
I want to go ahead and do two more podcasts before I snuff it.
Right.
Maybe we cut this off before I just said that. The one is on Tommy Robinson.
Yeah.
And the other is on that last Friday of the month meeting I had at the IEA, which was truly remarkable, but sadly didn't get properly recorded. And I want to emphasize how remarkable it was, and I want to encourage people to say things about it and send them to Rob Fisher.
Right, okay. So we can talk about, well, we can just talk about what people said, I suppose. Would there be anything else?
My name's Brian Micklethwaite, you're Patrick Crozier, and this is, again, what is it?
Tuesday the 5th of October, 2021.
Yep.
And we're going to talk about...
And this story begins when I was diagnosed with lung cancer.
Which was December 2020, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that's right. And at the time, it felt rather like a death sentence. And so it is proved. The spread of the cancer hadn't been abated. It at first, it was abated. But I had a recent dose of radiotherapy, which did not do the trick, and that means I'm not long for this world. And already I had come to a conclusion that I would like a living funeral. That is, I would like all my friends to gather and tell me that I've done good stuff over the years. And
yes.
The only thing that stopped me doing that was the feeling that even that was a bit over the top. I mean, I said, if you want to cheer me up, say nice things about me. What I really wanted to do was to get together in one place and say them all at once. And I thought, that won't happen. You know, people are just not that bothered, not that willing to put themselves out for another person like that. But, to my surprise and delight, Saeed Kamal of the IEA said, why don't we do that? Why don't we have an event?
So you put the idea to him, is that?
No, I didn't.
Oh, you didn't, okay, right.
No, he arrived at it quite separately,
oh,
I
right.
think.
Okay, good.
I put the idea to him in the sense that I wanted people to say nice things about me, and this was his version of them doing that. And I seized upon it and said, yes, please, can we do that? That's exactly what I want. And it went ahead on September the 3rd, and it was extraordinary. It was extraordinary because of all the nice things people said about me as a libertarian and the influence and mentoring I'd done over the years. helping speakers give talks, helping pamphleteers write pamphlets, encouraging important libertarians when they just needed it, you know, just the point in their life when they needed a dose of encouragement. Mark Littlewood was especially interesting on that. He remembers a dinner party which he addressed. I was present and various other libertarians. And I wrote very positively about what he said at that dinner party. And he had not forgotten.
And nor had Steve Davis, nor had Sam Bowman. These are also libertarian big cheeses, as I call them.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was very gratifying to me, very gratifying.
And lots of
And everybody present liked the fact that it wasn't just me being a libertarian swank. It was me being just any. I could have been anybody, you know. And they were thinking, a lot of them were thinking, I'd like this for me. Because it used to be that the Church of England burial service was the congregation assembling together and praying to God, look after this dearly departed one who was a good person. He was a good grandmother or a good good whatever he was, you know. But so in other words, the event on the night went beyond the fact that it was a libertarian. It went straight to the fact that it was another human being.
Brian, I think at some point you're going to have to accept that you're a bit special. With all the will in the world, I don't think they're going to be doing that for me. I don't think my contributions have been anything like yours. I don't think as many people know who I am as they know who you are. I haven't been doing this for as long as you have, and certainly not in the same intensity or depth. Brian, a lot of people are going to miss you, and it's not just me for what we were talking about earlier about, you know, this whole business about Todd and McCloskey. I mean, goodness, I mean, you know, the fact you can do this now, still be thinking about things, and the depth of your thought, and the way I don't see this, the process going on, but you're clearly questioning things all the time.
Yeah.
Trying to get down to what is the answer? Why does this happen in this way? That sort of thing. And most of us, include myself in this, don't do that. We've settled on this ideology, and we will do everything. There's a ring fence this to protect this ideology from any outside interference, and try to attack the uncivilized, unwashed, unlibertarianized, you know, masses. But your view is libertarianism can still be questioned. I mean, that doesn't stop you being a libertarian. You have that self-confidence that you know it's not going to change your views because your views are well thought out. But you're prepared to dig in. I mean, things like the tyranny of the facts, which I love so much, is because you're digging in. Why do we think the way we do? How do we come up with our beliefs? And it's not due to the facts particularly, or maybe the facts have a role in this, but so do other things.
Can we take a breather? Are you in a fit state to do Tommy Robinson now?
Yeah, absolutely I am, if you are.
Yeah. Well, why don't we...
I thought you were going to do a bit more about your living funeral, if you want to. I mean, I'm quite happy to finish with that.
Well, you can start now, yes.
Oh, no, I'm recording.
Are you recording?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Good. Well, let's do it.
So are we doing Tommy Robinson, or are we doing
living funeral? Because it's important to me that I learn new things as well as just sound off about the things I've been thinking about.
I'd gone into a rant about how good you are, and I thought you might have other things to say about September the 3rd.
Well... mainly, I think I can finish what I have to say about September the 3rd, which was, please gather your thoughts, any that you expressed on the night, any that you might have, but didn't have time to, because so many people wanted to say things. But please express those thoughts to Rob Fisher in writing, and it's important that they be thoughts that you're prepared to share with absolutely anyone. I like it when people send me nice emails and phone calls and things, but that's not what I'm really on about this time. I want public praise for not just me, but for the whole event, which was truly remarkable.
Yeah, it was. It was a very, well, it was a very nice evening.
Yeah. More so than I expected for all those present. And that includes friends who know me personally, but not as a libertarian. I think they were a bit surprised to hear all these libertarian heavyweights taking turns to say what a difference I'd made.
Yeah,
I was too. And I think they were impressed in the same sort of way that I would be if somebody had shown up and talked about Gus being a brilliant bridge designer, which he is and was and has been.
Gus is a friend of yours. He was there, was he?
He's my only school friend that I've still got.
Was he the guy with the white hair who was talking about you cycling holiday?
That's correct. Right, okay. He was.
Yeah.
And he's the father of my first goddaughter. And I think all of them in their way have been rather surprised and impressed to hear this stuff being said. So my first goddaughter was at the meeting on September the 3rd, and I think we'll have been a bit amazed by some of the things she heard. You know, she knew that libertarianism mattered to me, but the fact that my libertarianism seems to have had some effect on lots of other people came a bit as news to her, I think.
Well, I suppose if you're not interested, you perhaps wouldn't know. So it's... I suppose you've probably been to some of your Fridays, and that looks like a very small number of people in a very small room.
Yeah, well, but that's exactly
more
what
than
it was.
That. There's a lot more going on, I think, with those things.
Yes.
Yeah, they were incredibly important to me, and obviously, by the sounds of it, to other people too.
Yeah, especially those who actually spoke at those meetings, because there's nothing like giving a talk to have to be clear, you know.
Yeah, I suppose so. Don't know. I have to think about that. I suppose you do have to put an effort into it and actually be.
Yeah, you do.
I think you said this before. You know, you don't actually know what you're going to say until you actually start writing it.
Yeah.
Because it helps clarify your ideas.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. I think that covers the Friday. I think if we put that out as a special thing, that would do.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure how this is going to be edited, but we'll. I'm sure I'll sort something out, and it will, I'm afraid, be in the fullness of time. So I can't give any promises. Mm-hmm. It might be too late. But anyway, we'll do something with it, as we have with the others. There's a backlog now, as you, I'm sure you're aware.
Yeah.
Shall we
Tommy
do Tommy
Robinson?
Robinson? Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
What I was going to do, I imagined giving a talk at one of your Fridays or someone else's Fridays about the ideology of Tommy Robinson. And I was going to talk about how the first I heard of him, this is some appalling racist who runs the English Defence League, who's, you know, knuckle-dragging ape, this sort of thing. And then I started listening to what he had to say in the days when he could actually appear on YouTube, and the first thing he said in this YouTube, I said he said he was not what people think he was, and boy is that true. I mean, the first thing is he's not a racist at all. I mean he believes in a multiracial Britain. That comes as a real surprise to lots of people. He is clearly anti-Nazi, and frequently on his now his Telegram feed is deleting Nazi comments and Nazi commentators, or racist comments and racist commentators. He just tells them to fuck off, because that's not what he wants. And for racists, he has an awful lot of black, Jewish, and other friends. He even put up a photograph a few months ago of a Muslim friend of his.
Yeah,
but that is his main beef. He really does think that, a liberal democracy is quite incompatible with Islam.
Yeah,
and the two can't live together, which is would not be controversial in this company, I think.
Well, I think it's conceivable that historically it may prove that the moderate Muslims can basically reinvent their whole religion and turn it into a force against Muslim fundamentalism. But if they do, they're having to run against the grain of their own holy books.
Well, I find it fascinating, the Ahmadiyyas, because they are the sort of the peaceful Muslims, and as I understand it, they had to invent their own Messiah in order to allow Islam to sort of go forward into a more peaceful world. It's awfully difficult to do, and most Muslims do not regard them as Muslims.
And I regard the project of turning Muslims into civilized people, who don't follow their holy books. You've got to get stuck into the holy books and say, this is wicked nonsense.
Yeah.
And if they ever do become, if Islam ever ceases to be the malign influence on human affairs that it, at its worst, it definitely is now, it'll be because people like me and you have and Tommy Robinson have criticized it.
Yes. Well, I hope that's the way things work. I don't know. History's an old thing. You know.
Yeah.
What did for Christianity? What made that into something dominant and often very unpleasant into something peaceful and?
I think creationism versus evolutionism was the critical argument.
Yeah.
While the Christians thought they were winning that one, they were very unpleasant people, and they still are. A creationist in America, Christian creationist, it's quite clear they behave very badly towards Richard Dawkins, which is why he often loses his rag with them and people call him strident and everything. My feeling is, if you knew the things that these creationists said about Dawkins, you'd understand why he thinks they're wicked bastards. And why he's strident in saying so.
I didn't know that.
Well, I don't know it for sure, but I strongly suspect it.
The other thing I was going to say about Tommy Robinson, which is not as important, is that he utterly loathes the police.
Yeah.
With an absolute passion. He certainly feels that he has been fitted up by them at least twice. I don't know. I simply don't know. It's conceivable that he's not being entirely straight with us. But certainly you do get the impression when there's some conflict between a crowd and the police, he's very much on the crowd's side.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how that's... I think he's probably wrong on that. But that's another part of his ideas.
Yeah. Well, in America, the important thing that's happening is that people are assembling at sporting events and shouting, "Fuck Joe Biden."
Yes. Yeah. I'm amazed at that.
It's the only way they have left to make Biden look foolish.
Wow.
I'm torn in half about whether America will shake itself loose of all this woke nonsense.
Well, we just don't know, do we? One does hope that maybe people have just got it. Maybe it's like the 70s again. Maybe just people have to realise how bloody awful the alternative is before they start doing something sensible. I hope it's not like that, because I don't want to go through the 70s again. Thank you very much. With the inflation.
Well, I probably won't see it, so it's not my fight. But I'd love to live another 50 years and see how things turn out.
Yeah.
What I find interesting about Tommy Robinson is that people succeed in creating this false idea of what sort of person he is. And then if you disagree, you're accused of supporting that false person.
Yes. Extraordinary, the sort of things going on. I mean, I saw this podcast. Didn't involve Robinson, but it did involve one of his best friends, who happens to be Jewish.
Hmm.
And then another guy pipes up and says, "Oh, I think you're wrong. I think Tommy Robinson's a racist." You know, he's saying this to a guy who knows him personally, intimately, for a very long time.
Mm.
And I thought, what a stupid thing to say. But I'm sure that's true of huge numbers of people out there who just you just take their views, I don't know, from the Guardian or the Independent or wherever, or perhaps the BBC, and don't ever question whether it's true or not.
This is how I feel about Trump. Whatever else he is not a racist.
No, it's a ridiculous thing to say. I mean, he's coarse, and he's rude.
Yeah.
And he sacks lots of people. So,
yeah.
But no, I mean, he's... I mean, I also find it, I mean, remarkable how many libertarians get bent out of shape by Trump. I didn't get that at all. I mean, you know, he seemed to be one of the most libertarian presidents ever, as far as I could see. Did a lot of good stuff in terms of, as I understand it, in producing regulation, just here and there, just abolishing things or deleting them or not renewing them. But no, it's... I don't understand that, but a lot of libertarians... There's a certain sort of libertarian I do not understand, I must confess.
Well, I think I do. They're more interested in appearances than they are in what's actually been said.
Yeah, maybe. Which I find odd for a...
I think, so do I.
You know, we claim that we have a better handle on reality than other ideologies. So you wouldn't have thought that image would trump, so to speak, substance.
Tommy Robinson. What else is there you want to say about Tommy Robinson? Anything in particular?
He's very much against illegal immigration. You'd expect that. He is very much against the lockdown and the not quite compulsory vaccination program. He thinks that is wrong, also dangerous. He will highlight every case of someone who's got vaccinated who becomes ill. And obviously, he one of his big friends is Avi Yemeni, who lives in Melbourne. Who was constantly reporting about the sort of the police state that that part of Australia's turned into. And that's sort of like two birds with one stone as far as Robinson is concerned. He's got both the police and the whole lockdown business. So he's sort of big on that. Yeah, I think that's about all I'd say. I think the one thing I would say, which sort of appalls me, I mean... Robinson is working class, for want of a better word. And as long as I can remember, the establishment has wanted the working class to be not racist and to be liberal and what have you. And here you have a guy who is not racist and liberal, and they hate him.
Yeah.
It's almost as if they were lying.
Yeah, I agree. That actually they are... They regard the whole working class as deplorable.
Yeah, exactly.
Tommy Robinson's a member, so he's deplorable.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm.
Yeah, that's about it for me and Tommy Robinson.
Well, good. I'm glad we've got a lot said.
Yeah.
Rather quickly this time round.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes. Shall we stop there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Can we? I'm getting tired.
Okay, I'm not surprised. Yeah, it's going. Okay, you want what I want to emphasize
is how different British thinking and German thinking was in about 1780.
Right.
The British were obsessed with improving, as Deirdre McCloskey calls it.
Improving?
Just improvism.
Improving. Right, okay, yeah. Right.
And the Germans were not. They were interested in how to be good Christians and good virtuous people. And for me, one of the great jokes of all this is that the two things in the world I most care about are the wealth explosion in Britain and the Beethoven, the whole Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, Schubert.
Do we have a handle into this? Or?
Well, one handle is that it happened at precisely the same time.
Oh, and I was going to say handle as in the composer.
Oh, yeah, he preceded it.
Yeah, he was a bit
full. And Bach, I think, was involved in it. But something happened to classical music in the late 18th century, which hadn't happened before. And it was a German thing, an Austrian thing.
I mean, you'll forgive my forgiveness, but I think of Beethoven's sort of emotional symphonies.
Yeah.
You know, which is quite different from Mozart, which is a lot more tidy, shall we say. Is that the difference you mean, or is it some other difference?
Well, what I have in common, what I'm thinking of, is what the Germans all were preoccupied with, which was making great classical music of a kind never done before. And the English were just, they had their heads elsewhere.
I mean, would it be to the extent that if you were a great composer in the German-speaking world, then that was really quite a thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really the thing I wanted to add, that when the new men in Britain were able to start thinking for themselves and had given up trying to conquer the old aristocracy, they did it with ideas about all the improvements that we've enjoyed since then. You know, better furniture.
Yeah. Whereas the German speakers were thinking about how to write a new symphony or a new cantata or something like that. That sort of,
Yes. Yeah.
Concerto.
And if you want to see the contrast, that's where you see it. And I don't remember Todd ever writing about that.
Right. I mean, do we have any ideas why this difference existed?
The Germans were different.
Right, okay.
They were thinking differently. And that's the difference that matters for these purposes.
Yeah.
Goethe.
It's odd because, the Prussians, for instance, were a very militaristic people. I don't like using the word militaristic because I think it's a bit sloppy, but I'll use that anyway. And you would have thought that Frederick William would be rather interested in improving his army and the technology that could be used for that. So you sort of wonder why they didn't encourage commerce and enterprise and these sorts of things.
There wasn't enough to encourage.
Hmm.
Only the British were thinking like that and making real headway.
Yeah.
My favourite moment is when George Stephenson looked at the steam engine he had in his coal mine, which was for getting water out of the coal mine and getting more coal out. And he also looked at the railways, which were wooden railways, which were for getting the coal down to the riverbank where it could be shipped off to London and elsewhere. And he thought to himself, hey, wait a minute. I mean, this is a slightly romanticized version of what really happened, because there are others thinking this as well. He thought to himself, why don't we put the locomotive, the steam engine, on the rails?
Yeah.
And the big change was that I saw a play about him in Newcastle, and he was quoted as saying, this is a means by which a man can make his way in the world. And the point is, people are thinking about railways as a passport to bourgeois glory, bourgeois dignity.
But there's also this idea that you can improve your own position.
Yeah.
You can get rich and acquire those things that go with wealth, like status.
Yes.
So, there's that as well going on.
And the only way that happened in Germany was when people like Mozart and Beethoven gave lip to the old aristocracy. When the aristocracy pulled their rank all over these new composers and said, oh, this is quite good, Mozart, not too bad, too many notes, Mozart would say to the Duke of somewhere or the Archbishop of Salzburg or somewhere, so which notes would you have got rid of, your glorious majesty, your glorious pompous?
I don't think you'd have said that to the King or to the Kaiser or to the Archbishop of Salzburg. Maybe you did, I don't know.
People did.
Oh, right.
Beethoven certainly did. Yeah, Beethoven. But they were quite aware of the fact that they regarded themselves as on a par with the old aristocracy. That was how they were fighting their old aristocratic battles in Germany.
I seem to remember you writing a blog post about this. And it's like something, I don't know, the Duke of Bavaria or something like that wanted to imprison Beethoven. Well, he couldn't because he was Beethoven.
Yeah.
And you can't, a prince with dictatorial powers can't jail the famous composer because he's the famous composer and he's just too big a character.
Yeah, yeah. He didn't play along.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really all that I wanted to add, but, and to talk about the the improvements the British ended up making, you know, railways, furniture,
medicine, steel, iron, coal, textiles.
Well, the steel iron was, a lot of that was German later in the century.
Yes.
Things like better agricultural chemicals to make agriculture more productive.
Yeah.
But the British were in on that as well, so yes, all that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
I've said that.
Thanks,
I hope
Brian.
You can spell that in somewhere. Cheers.
We will. Bye. Right, bye now.